Good morning. Those of you sitting out there, if you want to come in here, you can. If you'd rather sit out there, that's okay, but there's room in here. Okay. Okay, so this morning I'm going to give my second talk on trusting heart mind, or trust in heart mind. My first talk I gave on my last Sunday talk, I'm going to keep doing this now for a while till I go through the entire prose poem. The first talk was just on the title, so. And I will review the first talk in a minute, 1 minute. So, the title, Trust in Heart Mind. Actually, there are no prepositions in Chinese. Prepositions are inferred, and you can either infer them or not infer them. So, what I said last time is that trust in heart mind is the trust that we have that we can move beyond fixation on our thinking and on our small self who is always getting things wrong and wants to get things right, to heart mind, to center of life. We have to have trust that we can do that through Zen practice, through our meditation practice. And furthermore, that the transition in on the path is from trust in heart mind to trusting heart mind. No in, right? That's the transition. Just the gradual elimination of the in, which actually does occur. Although it can be sudden, too. And it can revert suddenly. And it can also revert to no trust in heart mind suddenly. But anyway, that's what this is about. Poem is by a prose poem is by Sung San. Sung San died in 606. We don't know too much about him except he's the third ancestor in Zen. The first one being Bodhidharma, the second one being Hui Ko. So this morning I will talk about the first stanza or two, depending on how you define a stanza. The great way is not difficult. Just let go of preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Pretty simple. So, going through it phrase by phrase, great. There are lots of translations to this. One of the translations is perfect. I much prefer great because perfect immediately gets you in a bind. Immediately you're trying to be perfect. And perfect is something that's contained. Great has no container. Great is open. Great is just the beating of your own heart. Your own heart. And its extension to all of life. I much prefer great. And then way. Well, what's way a translation of? Some of you guys know. What's it a translation of? Tao. Tao. So here we have, in the 6th century, we've got Taoism and Buddhism coming together, which creates Zen. Red Pine and I have a disagreement on this. They create Zen, big time. Big time. This is the first teacher who really brings Taoism in. Bodhidharma didn't bring Hui Ko. We don't have any writings of Hui Ko, so we don't know if Hui Ko brought Taoism in. Bodhidharma didn't bring Taoism in. Why? Because Bodhidharma was Indian. Bodhidharma didn't know anything about Taoism. So this is the well, maybe he did know a little bit. Yeah, but it wasn't what he was trained in. It was some foreign deal, right? So Tao. So Zen is Zen because of the fusion, the coming together of Taoism and Buddhism in China, starting in the 6th century. So let's see. So what's Taoism about? Well, I've taught courses in Taoism, so try to be succinct here. I want to make a few points about how they complement one another, about how Buddhism and Taoism complement one another. So Buddhism is about discipline. It's about the discipline of containing ego and coming back to just your meditation, to just your vow, to try to help all beings time and time again. And using the precepts, using guidelines for behavior to do that, containing and disciplining yourself so that you can, as Katagiri Roshi used to say, that's putting a snake in a bamboo pole. That's what he said Zen practice was. Now, where he got that, that must have come from China. I don't know. But anyway, that's what he said. It's putting a snake in a bamboo pole. And, you know, those of you who are sitting with me for the last 40 minutes may have experienced a little bit of that, especially if you're not proficient at this yet. Putting a snake in a bamboo pole. So that's the discipline that we have to do in order to kind of slow down and contain all the worries and the fears that dominate our lives so that we can settle into heart-mind, on the one hand. On the other hand, the complement to that is Taoist spontaneity. Spontaneity, giving ourselves completely to this moment. We don't know anything. We just give ourselves. We just open our heart. We just extend. We just do it. And without that complementary side, our Buddhism can get pretty tough guy Buddhism, and pretty tough on us guys Buddhism too. And then we might as well be in the military or something. You know, we need to be careful of that. We need to be careful of it. So that's the first one. The second one is Buddhism is very serious. This is serious shit you guys are getting yourselves into. Do you realize this? Leave now if you so choose. Leave now. This is serious shit. It's serious. It's hard to deal with ego. It's hard to put with ego to put the snake in a bamboo pole. The snake hates it. It's serious. And it takes great determination to come back and back and back, day after day, to the same cushion, to the same worries, to the same fears, to the same wandering monkey mind, moment after moment, day after day. That's hard. That's hard. And Bodhidharma, our founder, look at his visages, look at his pictures. What's he look like? This guy is serious, man. Look at him. He is serious. He's beyond serious. He's so serious you may not want to get in the room with him. On the other hand, what is Taoism? Taoism is full of humor. Lao Tzu and Trunks are always making jokes. They're always cavorting. And their disciples are always cavorting. They're always collapsing our dichotomies. They're collapsing our idea of ego and heart-mind and this and that. And they're doing it with delight, with humor, almost with slapstick comedy sometimes. Almost, you guys are not as old as me, but when I was young, I used to watch Laurel and Hardy. The Taoists are almost like Laurel and Hardy. Only a lot of them. And you can see that reflected in Zen. From the 6th century on, all of Chinese Zen, we have this. Never had it in Buddhism before. So we need that. We need to relax a little bit. We need to enjoy a little bit. Just how we get in these rigid mindsets. Han, Shan, and Shite. Han, Shan, and Shite were not monks. They never got ordained. What did they do? You know the story. They hung outside the monastery, catcalling, when they'd see the monks sweeping the dust around the monastery, but they just made more dust with their sweeping and holding up their scrolls, which had what on them? You know the pictures, right? Nothing. Nothing. So. And I have upstairs on my altar in my office, in my room where I have one-to-ones with people, I have a picture of Katagiri. One side, it was taken during a retreat. And is that guy serious? I mean, he is just, The other side, he's nothing but a smile. There's nothing but a smile. Totally. There's no one there smiling. There's no one there. It's just a smile. The two go together. They go together. They go together. And we need both. We get our nurturance from both. Order and precise attention. Which one is that, Buddhism or Taoism? Which one is that, you guys? Buddhism or Taoism? Huh? Buddhism. Order and precise attention. Attention, attention, attention. You do your origo like this, not like this. When you get into the zendo, you stand there, not there. You bow like this, not like this. Right? Order, detail. And of course, if you go into a Japanese session, it's nothing but order and detail. And I could never keep up. Although now I don't care, but in those days I was always trying to keep up. Always trying to get it right. I remember Katagiri had to get off his seat here once and go help me with the Orioki in front of everybody else. Because I did a little detail wrong. Well, the problem with the Orioki, those are our nested eating bowls, you guys, that we have if you do formal routine. Problem with that, if you'd make one mistake, then the whole thing. So it wasn't that he was being picayune, it was that I had made one mistake, so the whole thing was thrown off. And why do we do that? Why do we do that in Buddhist practice? We do that because that helps the mind settle down. We don't have to think. We don't have to anticipate. And we can be really present with each detail of our body, of our mind, of our movement. And the mind can just be with that. It doesn't have to anticipate. It doesn't have to plan. And so it becomes kind of a dance. And when it's a complete dance, where are you? Where is the critical mind? Gone. Or still. At least still. So that's Buddhism. Well, what's Taoism? What do the Taoists have to say? Now I'm going to read a Taoist story here. The emperor of the South Sea was called Shu. The emperor of the North Sea was called Hu. This already sounds like Abbott and Costello or something, doesn't it? But this is a serious one, you guys. The emperor of the South Sea was called Shu. The emperor of the North Sea was called Hu. And the emperor of the central region was called Hun Tun, chaos. Chaos. Shu and Hu, from time to time, came together for a meeting in the territory of King Chaos. And Chaos treated them very generously. Shu and Hu discussed how they could repay his kindness. All men, they said, have seven openings so they can see, hear, eat, and breathe. But King Chaos alone doesn't have any. Let's try boring him some. Every day they bored another hole, and on the seventh day, King Chaos died. So, this is a little bit of a different connotation of chaos, our usual connotation, right? So, digging holes means destroying the natural state. Destroying the natural state. To the ancient Chinese, chaos not only has the meaning of disorder, but it also presents a way of being. A way of being. Trungpa Rinpoche, building on the Taoist, said what? We should greet chaos as extremely good news. As extremely good news. Our lives are chaotic. The world is chaotic. It's completely unpredictable. We completely don't know. If you think things are in control now, wait till tomorrow. On all levels. On a global level, on a socioeconomic level, and on an interpersonal and an intrapersonal level. And you get it together for a little while. But you should learn to welcome chaos as extremely good news. That's the Taoist teaching. And actually, it grows out of this practice of doing zazen, of doing meditation, and of the putting the mind on hold and attending to details. Because when we do that, we begin to let go of our comparing, of our evaluating, of our wishing for a world that wasn't chaotic. To two more, and these are all really the same, you know. Transcending. Which one's about transcending? Buddhism. Overcoming the world of form, especially in the Dhammapada, especially in Theravadan Buddhism. Overcoming the world of form, transcending, entering this timeless state, this wonderful timeless state where there's no self, no other. Gyate, 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 as we say in the gone, 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 as we say in the Heart Sutra. Transcending. And then, of course, the Taoists, fusing with nature, appreciating nature, enjoying the sky, enjoying the earth, enjoying the birds, and actually fusing from them, getting their teaching from them. Listening to the teaching of the sky, feeling the teaching of the earth, which is not a verbal teaching, which is just the teaching of heart-mind, trusting heart-mind. Always, always. So we have, then in Zen, all of a sudden Buddhism is into nature. Buddhism's never been into nature before Zen. All of a sudden the teachers are talking about, you know, their poems about the water and the sky and the earth and the mountains and Zen poetry, which goes on for centuries, is really the coming together of Buddhism and Taoism. And Dogen has both the transcendent. Dogen, the Japanese teacher who's kind of our founder of the school, he has both the real deep appreciation of nature, if you read his poems, and then the transcendence. And then back to the appreciation, so don't get hung up on the transcendence. And don't get hung up on the appreciation. And two more. Again, these are really the same. Masculine. Which one's masculine? Everybody's got it by now, don't you? Buddhism is masculine, right? This is hard shit. You know, you sit still. Nobody smiles at each other. Nobody moves. Come to a retreat and see how friendly people are to you, right? This is masculine. It takes determination over and over again. On the other hand, this is Zen. It includes the feminine of the Tao. The Tao is never referred to as a father, always a mother. The mother of everything. The mother which includes everything, who extends herself to everything, who is everything. Because it's trusting heart mind. Trusting heart mind. And soft. It's receptive. It's open. It takes it all in. Doesn't try to be anything other than what she is already. Doesn't have any favorite kids. They're all her favorite kids. How could she have favorite kids? And finally, abstinence. Again, Buddhism, right? Abstinence. Dhammapada, the time of the Dhammapada, well, no sex, right? No food after noon, only one robe. Of course, it's India. Minnesota, probably they'd allow two or something, right? Abstinence. Where is that? What's that abstinence all about? Well, again, if ego gets all entangled in sex, drugs, and rock and roll, it can't calm down. It can't return to the center. It can't open up to trusting heart mind. So there needs to be some abstinence, at least during retreats, at least while you're on your cushion. And hopefully there's some carryover. There's some carryover. On the other hand, Taoism doesn't have anything to do with abstinence. As a matter of fact, when we see the Taoist sages in the mountains, often they're drinking wine. And there's a whole Taoist sexuality thing, which I will not go into today. appreciating the senses, appreciating just the light in this room and the light coming in from the windows. Hearing the sound of the shakuhachi, the wonderful shakuhachi, and then this, and then hearing the silence when Leo stops playing. Appreciating that silence that surrounds each of those notes. Enjoying a good tasting piece of food, even if it is chocolate. Especially chocolate. Just taking it in. Just completely being with it. Nothing else. Nothing to compare to. That's Taoism. That's the Taoism that comes into and makes Zen along with the abstinence. So appreciating the senses without craving. Because through absence we learn to settle down, settle ego down, settle ego down, so there's not so much craving. And then there can be just appreciation of immediate sensory reality. Does that make sense? You remember Fritz Perls saying, which I've used many times before, we lose our minds so we can come to our senses. And why? That's what we do. We lose our minds so we can come to our senses. But we have to put ourselves in a bamboo, whatever, pole. Well, that's what it is, pole. I can't remember what it was. It's such a strange phenomenon to me. You know? Okay, so that's the great Tao. So that's how, that's the great Tao, the great way. So the great way, the great Tao, is not difficult. Oh yeah, it's not difficult. Not difficult. Well, that's cool. It's not difficult. But what's the first two teachings of Buddhism? That life entails dissatisfaction, suffering, dissatisfaction. That's difficult. That's difficult, and it's that dissatisfaction is due to thirst, to feeling like we don't have what we want. We can't get no satisfaction. We try and we try and we try, but we can't get no satisfaction. And the harder we try, the more no satisfaction we get. Right? This is the life situation. This is a life situation. And this is how Buddha's teaching starts, how Buddha started his teaching. And so we try to get our satisfaction through our partner, through our job, through our kids. When our kids fly off, through our grandkids. Maybe through being a Zen priest. Oh, finally, now I'll do something really good, really that will help people. Be a Zen priest, be a Zen teacher. Be enlightened, act in an enlightened way, even better. Right? We thirst for satisfaction. We thirst for satisfaction. And when we do that, when we thirst so strongly, we don't have trust in heart mind. Because the thirsting for satisfaction takes over everything. And we've forgotten that we can have trust in this heart mind. It's always beating. It's always beating. Sometimes it's beating fast, sometimes it's beating slow. It's always beating. And it's the heart mind of the universe, very simply. But you don't have to think about that or make a big deal about that. So, the great way is not difficult. Just let go of preferences. Huh, okay. Just let go of preferences. Okay, that's the deal. Just let go of preferences. So, the second teacher, second ancestor, the first guy is Bodhidharma, second guy is Hui Ko, and third guy is this teacher, Sung San. So we don't know much about Wei Ko, but we know one thing, right? That interchange between Bodhidharma and Wei Ko, which went like this, supposedly. Probably this is all mythology. But who cares? Wei Ko had been practicing meditation. He had been practicing meditation for a long time. And we can assume that he was practicing meditation similar to what we practice, well, we don't know. It would have been a form of shamatha, a form of concentration meditation, because that was what was taught there. Whether it's concentrating on the breathing, concentrating on putting your mind in your belly, something to bring you back, a concentrated form of meditation. So he'd been practicing that for a long time. He came to visit the famous teacher Bodhidharma. Supposedly Bodhidharma was in his cave, right? Or he'd been hanging out for 9 years. He was kind of maybe he was an antisocial personality or something. And he said, "My mind is not at peace. My mind is not at peace." That's what he said. He'd been doing this meditation for we don't know how long. You do this meditation over and over again, and then your mind's still not at peace. What's going on? What's going on? Maybe you feel less like giving up, or finding another teacher or something, or maybe just doing some yoga. At least with yoga, you stretch and you feel some immediate pleasure. With Zazen, what do you feel? Well, there is calmness there. There is the heart mind there. It's just that we don't get the immediate gratification that we do with yoga. We don't get it. Well, that's part of the whole thing. That's part of the whole thing. So that we can settle down. So, my mind is not at peace. My mind is not at peace. And Bodhidharma, being the guy that Bodhidharma was, says, "Show me your mind. Where's the mind that's not at peace?" So Wei Ko goes off and he does meditation for some more. We don't know how long. Some people say 10 days, some people say 10 months. He went off and meditated more. And now his meditation switched a little bit. So it wasn't so much focused on concentration meditation, because he knew how to concentrate. He had that. He had mastered that after practicing for 10 years. Maybe not completely mastered it, but let's say at least, I don't know, half mastered it. We don't really know. We just extrapolate. And so instead, he was trying to find this mind. Bodhidharma said, "Show me your mind." So he was then engaging in what's called insight meditation. He didn't know it, but he was looking into the layers. This is Vipassana, original Vipassana, looking into the patterns that make up the mind. Looking into them, seeing how they're self-created, seeing how this pattern is due to something my dad said to me in 1962. That's why it keeps coming up over and over again. Right? Seeing into those. And ultimately, there is a seeing into the supposed creator of the patterns. Because who creates the patterns? Pattern? It's the coagulation of patterns that creates the so-called creator. So the seeing, whether it's seeing through layer after layer or it's big seeing, is ultimately what he discovered. And so he discovered something after 10 days or 10 months or 10 years. He had a breakthrough. He came back to trusting heart and mind. No longer trust in heart and mind. He had to have a lot of trust in heart and mind to do this, though, to keep doing this, especially since Bodhidharma was not very helpful to him. He didn't have much Taoism. Bodhidharma had no Taoism, no feminine side. Just so he comes back and he sees Bodhidharma and he said, he's relieved, he's relaxed, he's open. He says to Bodhidharma, "I searched everywhere for this mind and suddenly realized that it's ungraspable, unattainable, unknowable." And he gave a deep smile. And that's the whole story. That's the whole story, right? And of course, I embellished on it. I did embellish on it. And I will continue to. Just as my teachers did, and their teachers did. Right? The great way is not difficult. Just let go of preferences. Just let go of preferences. So people, a number of people in this room are doing a 50. Yeah. 55-day practice period. I had to get my math here. It's 8 weeks, 8 times 7, 56-day practice period. And they are about something like 8 days into it, or 9 days into their practice periods. Go back to the beginning of Buddhism, making a commitment to putting the snake in the bamboo pole for 55 days. So they fill out commitment sheets. They're going to sit so much every day. They're going to attend so many retreats. They're going to come to our class where we're studying this stuff. Not to get smart, but to encourage our trust in heart mind. Because lots of times we lose our trust. We lose it. And we have to come back. Always coming back. So they fill out their commitment sheets and they give them to me, which is their intention. It's their intention to practice. Their intention to trust in heart mind for these 56 days. Their intention to let go of their preferences in their sitting during these 56 days. And when a preference comes up, just to see it, but not to make a huge drama out of it, not to make it a three-act Shakespearean tragedy. My goodness, what we do. We are trips, aren't we? They make that commitment. That's their intention, the second step on the Eightfold Path, our intention, an intention to practice. An intention to just see whatever thought bubbles up as a bubble, to watch it, the good thoughts, the bad thoughts, the in-between thoughts, and let it pop. And it'll pop when it's ready. It'll pop when, and then another bubble will come. So, big deal. Big deal. Only if we're trying to get somewhere. But intention is not about a goal out there. Intention is about to come back and this commitment to be here. To be here. To come back to heart mind. To feel this heart beating right now. Right now. Whether you're discouraged, whether you're elated, whether you're depressed, whether you're right now. And preferences are hard. It's hard for us to do this. It's hard for us to let go of preferences, even though the sage here says, just let go of preferences. It's hard. That's why we practice this over and over again. Because preferences are our shields. Preferences are our armor. Preferences are the way we get through life without feeling too much pain. And I'm not talking about just preferences of chocolate over vanilla ice cream. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about our deeply held beliefs that give us security, and that we are so attached to. We are so attached to. Preferences help us stay put and avoid having to go into the realm of King Chaos. They help us stay put. We think we like King Chaos, but we don't like King Chaos. We don't want to go in there. And preferences help us stay insulated from King Chaos. So I came here from California when I was a young man. My wife and I both came here. And we came here because we loved the North Shore, and I had been here in the North Shore when I was a child, and I had an aunt there. And my wife in those days just kind of followed me. She doesn't do that anymore. She did that. She said, enough of that. So we came here, but I realized after I'd been for a while that I came here to get away from my family, from my parents, and from the toxicity of my relationship with my father. The poison in my system from that. To get away from King Chaos. Sometimes we have to go away from King Chaos. we have to go away from King Chaos and settle down, find our heart again, discover that we can have some trust in heart and mind again, a little trust before we go in. But then after I came here, I went back and forth to California. Sometimes I would go back. Sometimes I would wait a while and not go back. Sometimes my father wouldn't talk to me. He would never come here. Sometimes he would talk to me, but just say a few things. Then I had grandchildren. Now, then he started softening up a little bit for his grandchildren. Then I had children. He had grandchildren. Now I have grandchildren. He started softening up a little bit. We cling to our preferences. We cling to this armor because it's risky to go into King Chaos. But through our meditation practice, we can do that more and more. We're able to do that more and more. We're able to go in there even though there's the pain, even though there's the confusion, even though there's the insecurity. And right in the center of King Chaos, like in the center of the cyclone, it's completely still. It's completely still. The heart mind is beating. How can it be other than that? How can it be other than that? So if your concentration practice is wobbly, those of you who are practicing for 56 days with me, and those of you who are practicing just today with me, that's okay. Don't worry about it. Don't get the inner critic all agitated about it. Just be with the wobbly. Just be with the wobbly. The wobbly will settle down. It'll settle down. Everything settles down. There's always that stillness here at the center of King Chaos. So now, I'm almost ready to close here, but first I want to read a poem from the great Zen master Pablo Neruda, who never heard of Zen, which is even better. Even better. That's the kind of Zen master I want to hang out with. Do you know what I mean? Then you get some idea of Zen. This is Zen practice. This is how I should be. Forget it! Forget it! How you should be is how the heart is. That's how you should be. Listen to it. Pay attention to it. Open it. Engage. Take a risk. You can't insulate yourself behind your preferences forever. Take a risk. Pablo Neruda. Now we will count to 12 and we will all keep still. For once on the face of the earth, let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for a second and not move our arms so much. It would be an exotic moment. Without rush, without engines, we would all be together in a sudden strangeness. Fishermen in the cold sea would not harm whales, and the man gathering salt would not look at his hurt hands. Those who prepare green wars, wars with gas, wars with fire, victories with no survivors, would put up on clean clothes and walk about with their brothers in the shade, doing nothing. What I want should not be confused with total inactivity. Life is what it is about. If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might interrupt the sadness of never understanding ourselves, of threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth can teach us, as when everything seems dead in winter and later proves to be alive. Now I'll count up to 12, and you keep quiet, and I will go. He will go. when little complaining, upset Tim goes, what's left? What's left? When little complaining Monica goes, who's left? Who's left? The great way is not difficult. Just let go of preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Clear and undisguised. Why, Zen teacher said you can't catch a feather with a fan. You can't catch a feather with a fan. But you can catch a feather. You can catch it. Just count to 12, and we'll all keep still. We'll all keep still. Okay. Good enough. Good enough. Questions, comments, concerns, stories, songs, fables. Mm-hmm. Larry.
I just have a question about chaos and dull.
Yeah.
When I think of chaos, I always think of disorder.
Disorder.
Sort of disorder, not coherence. When I think of the dull, I think of a way maybe having some kind of flow or coherence. So what would you say is the difference between chaos and the dull?
No difference. No difference. The Tao includes chaos. It welcomes chaos. And there's something, because everything is unpredictable. We don't know. We think we've got our things lined up, but nothing's lined up. Everything's always changing. But it's not necessarily disorder. We say, oh, disorder. It's just what it is. So you could say it's chaos, but it's a chaos that includes, that doesn't, isn't in contrast to order. It just doesn't have any order to it. It's just that we can fathom. There's cause and effect, and there's cause and effect, and there's interdependence, but it's really unfathomable. We really can't get it. And when we just let go of trying to get it, and we just accept the chaos of it, then we're manifesting the Tao. Then our heart is open and our mind is still. So, it is chaotic. Everything's chaotic, but it's not chaotic in contrast to order. That's just a, it's just what is.
It's something like which might be the difference between nirvana and samsara.
Nirvana and samsara? Well, you could say that. Yeah, do you want to continue with your thought? Let's see where you're going with your thought.
Well, I just in the idea of bonds and so the same and kind of depending on how you,
that's right,
how you see it.
That's right. So the samsaric world in Buddhism is the world conventional reality, which does always seem to be out of control, which does seem to be always causing us pain and confusion. And the nirvanic world is, nirvana means to blow out. So we stop. The mind stops trying to figure it out, stops trying to get it right, and just counts to 12 and is quiet. Just counts to 12 and is quiet. And then there's no difference between nirvana and samsara, because things are just what they are. More thoughts are coming up. More chaos is coming up. But it's not anything we have to fight with, not anything we have to struggle with, because it's just what's happening. Other people? Yeah.
Okay, if Bodhidharma is off secluded in a cave for 9 years, how did anybody find him?
Oh.
How did a student manage to find him when he's way out in a cave?
Well, you know, according to the mythology is that the the farmers and the hunters around the area began to see this guy and pick up on his vibes and went there and gave him meals and saw that he was just sitting. You know how he sits? I can't even do it. Actually, I do it, but I can't do it when I'm trying to do it, right? So they thought, oh, you know, this is great. He's just sitting there, so we'll come feed him, and you know, and then stories began to. So then they, oh, he's Indian. He's an Indian Buddhist. Well, Buddhism is new in China. The Chinese say, oh, this, you know, so he's a myth before anybody ever even talks to him. I just saw that movie last night, Social Networks. This guy, Mark Zuckerberg, the poor guy, he's a myth before anybody's ever met him. If you see the movie, you don't even need to see the movie. The guy who started Facebook. Does that make sense? Anything else? Thank you.